Coming up on the Shelley Irwin Show podcast today, composer Greg Scheer presents The Shadows. The president of Davenport University joins in to talk about the upcoming Excellence in Business Gala 2026. Future Farmers of America are hosting Lucky Droppings, a unique bingo to raise money for the group. We get the details. And we talk about the books The Fortune Tellers of Rue de Rue and The Unlikely Tale of Chase and Finnegan.
Our next guest has been doing big events, been in church ministry for some time, and now composer Greg Scheer presents The Shadows, a modern classical music album, timely this Holy Week. We will discuss. Good morning to you, Greg Scheer.
Good morning, Shelley.
How long did you spend in church ministry?
Oh, 20 or 25 years, something like that.
Are you a self-described musical omnivore?
I am. I cannot touch down on one thing. I don't know if that's latent ADHD or what.
Whatever drives you to your own success.
Well, and it keeps it interesting, right?
That's right. Well, yes, it is Holy Week. We do pause to discuss and to correlate what may be happening. In general, you a composer. Has music always been in your life?
Yeah, so... You know, I failed at piano lessons when I was like, 6 or 7. But then I really wanted to take up trombone because a friend was doing it, right? So you want to join in. And at that point, I realized that I had aptitude at music in general, just not piano in particular. So, and ever since then, I mean, by the time I was 13, I knew I wanted to be a composer.
Good. And here you are, a couple 13 years older,
yes,
as they say.
Yes.
How did and what is The Shadows? How did it come to be?
So the Shadows is a piece for 7 cellos, and so I'd been in church ministry for a long time. I was at Church of the Servant at that time, and we were kind of discussing what would happen for the Holy Week services. And I mentioned that I had always wanted to do a piece for 7 flutes. All right, so the Tenebrae service is 7 readings following Christ's crucifixion, leading up to his crucifixion. And it's the service of the shadows. It's a very powerful service where one candle at a time is extinguished. And so I had always thought, I'd love to write musical interludes for that. And I was thinking flutes. But it turns out that we had gobs and gobs of cellists, but not a lot of flutes. And so I got writing. I was writing in February. I often do a thing called February Album Writing Month. And so I made this my project. I wrote it for 7 flutes. 7 cellos. One of those cellists was my young son, Theo. And it was really fun being able to write kind of to the abilities of the people. And the idea is that after each reading would be a musical interlude, starting with 7 cellos in the beginning. And then that 7th cello stands up, extinguishes a candle, walks off the stage. Another musical interlude. 6th cellist walks off until there's just 1 cello, almost in complete darkness. It's a very, very powerful service.
So more on what is it, Tenebrae, a service of darkness?
Yeah, so, you've got all of these services, if you get really wonky about the liturgics of it. You've got Maundy Thursday, Good Friday, and they all have these kind of different things about them. But some churches do a service of the upper room, kind of following the Last Supper. And then some churches do a Tenebrae service, which is those 7 readings, service of darkness. Some will strip all the decorations out of the service, leaving the sanctuary completely in black. And I first experienced it when I was in college, and it was a very, very powerful thing for me. And it's been kind of a touchstone ever since then.
Wow. Powerful. After, as you mentioned, after each reading, one of the cellists gets up, extinguishes that candle, leaves the stage. What are your local connections here? Move to here.
Yeah, so we recorded this with 3 cellists from the Grand Rapids Symphony: Andrew Plesher, Jin Shin, and Shirley Kim. And now you may be wondering, how did we record 7 cellos with 3 cellists? Kind of the way we decided to go about this, because they leave, and you're quickly down to 3, 2, 1. We decided that we could do it with 3 cellists. And in fact, what we did, Stuart Poltrock was the recording engineer on this. And he came up with this great idea. So the problem is, when you're trying to do multi-tracking music, usually in a studio, you do that with a click track. All right. So everybody's listening to a click, 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 click at the tempo. But you don't want that with classical music. And so what Stuart proposed was that I would conduct the earlier movements. I would conduct the three people and pretend that I was conducting the other four, and they would videotape me. And then that would mean that the cellists would be responding to the same conductor when they went back to multitrack. So it was really, you know, kind of a ingenious way of kind of skinning that musical cat.
See what happens behind the scenes?
It
just doesn't appear like the stork and the baby.
Yes.
Now, I think because of Joe Bierlicki's talents, we may have a sample of what you present. And if you can kind of describe what might we be hearing. So let me push.
So you're going to play septet?
I don't know. I think we're doing quintet.
Okay, but, and that's totally fine.
Take a listen.
Yeah.
Greg Shear, is that a quintet?
It is. We're down to five cellos at this point.
Oh, good. We'll play that throughout and in our closing. The tech story, the video feed to allow the three cellos to play all seven parts. How unique is this?
You know, it was completely unique to me. When he proposed this, I was like, oh, that's perfect. Because I really didn't know how we were going to do it otherwise.
You, again, a musical omnivore. Your style's roughly into those four areas. Before I go into that, where do we hear The Shadows? What's the next step?
A great place to hear it is on Bandcamp. It's gregshearmusic.bandcamp.com/album/the-shadows. So just look up my name and The Shadows. You'll find it.
I think we're going to cut
and
to
just
the
spell
chase.
My name, S-C-H-E-E-R, and then that'll get you even closer.
Yes. How does this fit into this week?
Well, I think that if you are a person that is observing Holy Week, then this is a way for kind of private devotions because the full album has the readings that are in the service and the cello interludes. So that's, I think, a good, you know, find yourself a nice dark room and listen. If you are not someone who observes Holy Week, it's, I think you would say like a sacred classical work, maybe in the style of Arvo Pärt, you know, so not super dissonant, but also not, real tonal and upbeat.
Yes. And, it's compared to Bach's cantatas, correct?
Minus the genius, yes.
Well, I guess you're right if we look at the big praise that I just shared with you. Your styles do fall into four areas, rock, jazz, sacred, modern. Take one of those.
Yeah, so, I I'm a musical omnivore. I'm attracted to very different styles of music. You know, I grew up listening to punk, but then playing in the jazz band and studying classical, and there's something I love about all of those. So in some ways, I've tried to, you know, for marketing, I've tried to separate those out a little bit. So a lot of my rock activity is with the St. Sinner Orchestra. My jazz stuff is with Outside Pocket. Those are both local groups. My sacred music is found at the gregshearmusic.com website. The classical music is, you know, really kind of... catch as catch can, right? Someone might commission a work, did some work with the Holland Symphony last year, different commissions and compositions like that. So, you know, I just keep moving in all these different areas. Like I'll leave here today and I'll start practicing for my St. Sinner concert. You know, completely different skill set in a lot of ways.
St. Sinner?
St. Sinner Orchestra.
Okay, very nice. What's this in your signature? What's your kind of your mantra?
Actually, I cut that off from my notes.
Oh, okay.
No day without a line.
Yes.
Yes.
Say
yes.
That in the language. It's
I can't remember it in Latin.
Nulla dies. I'm not going there.
Nul dislinia. I can't remember.
Linea. No day without a line.
Exactly. So it's was it Paul Klee? I can't remember who.
Yes.
Paul Klee
with the K L E E.
Yes, and That was his motto, and I love it. It's no day without a line. He was committed to drawing every single day, even if it's just a little bit. And I feel that way. Picasso had the same kind of approach, where you get better at something by doing it, and you don't sit around waiting for the muse to come. You actually just start writing and create some space for that artistic thing to happen. So I really try hard to every day sit down at the piano with my pencil and my notepaper and write something, even if it's really crummy.
That probably doesn't happen at this point in your life, but you're honest. How do we find out more about The Shadows, please?
So yeah, I would go to Bandcamp. It's also on Spotify. All of the, you know, normal streaming services. It's not a physical album at this point. It's just digital. So yeah, any streaming site is going to have it. Greg Scheer, SCH, and then The Shadows.
Yes, and going out with your quintet. Thank you, Greg, for this opportunity.
Thank you so much, Shelley.
Again, in advance, congratulations to the president of Davenport University, Rick Pappas, enjoying his, well, couple months into his reign of ending. So stand by. We're going to ask about your legacy, but you've got a lot of work to do until June 30th comes. Dr. Richard Pappas, glad that you are in studio. Appreciate you.
Thank you very much. Good to see you, Shelley.
Good to see you. We're also here to talk about your yet again wonderful Excellence in Business Gala for this year, which will be coming up very shortly, May 2. Always a fun way to watch you in action with Martin Short.
It's going to be exciting. He's so creative, you know, a Tony Emmy Award winner. He's full of energy, so I'm looking forward to it.
And you aren't? You are full of energy.
I think he's got more energy than me, though.
Well, there might be that. Yes, Saturday, May 2nd, of course, the wonderful DeVos Place, a black tie event. RSVP at davenport.edu will start there. And obviously, this is a traditional event that brings the likes of the celebrities, awards, you doing the interview. What else is important about this important gala?
The most important part is that we raise money for student scholarships. We've raised over $2 million, and this is how so many students are able to go to school, and the generosity of donors and of people who care. And this has been a real wonderful experience. Named Peter C. Cook, you know, who was a great friend of the university. And I had a chance to meet him when I first got here.
A
wonderful
nice
guy.
Nice.
Very humble. And but it was great to meet him.
Yes. Well, get your sleep the night before, because this is personally a big evening for you. Not only will you be having an exclusive conversation with Martin Short, but finally you get to receive the Peter C. Cook Excellence in Business Award recipient. Sometimes it takes a person to leave the committee to get the award.
Well, you know, after 17 turndowns, they came to me and said, we need somebody. So
probably not, but I'll let you do what you do best with your wonderful humor. Dr. Richard, again, Rick Pappas with us. So, yes, I look at the many recipients of the award, from Peter Cook himself,
yes,
in 1998 to Dr. Chang last year. That was wonderful. And again, your students receiving the scholarships to do what they do so well with Davenport. How's Davenport University?
You know, Davenport University, we've hit a number of highs this year. We hit a 200% increase in graduation rate since 08-09, and a 33% increase in retention, which is hard to do because we have almost 50% of our students are first-generation students, and about 34% of our students are students of color. We love that diversity within the institution. And so we've been able to increase retention. We're at 80% now. We were at 60% in 08-09. And this is a tribute to the faculty and staff at the university. And we've created creative visions each 5 years, and I named it Vision 2015, Vision 2020. I mean, I'm creative there. And so Vision 2030, which is very cool, Shelley, that how are we integrating AI into every program? It's because it's a skill. These are skills that you're going to need to have, the human-centered skills especially. We've got all this data coming in, but you're still going to have to make decisions where you drive it. And we're having one of the first three-year bachelor's degrees to be approved by the Higher Learning Commission in advanced marketing. So we're excited about that probability. So that's coming soon. And so I'm having a great time. You know, we have the best faculty and staff. We have a great board of trustees who care. So whoever replaces me is going to be in a great position.
No one can replace you. It'll be just the next carrier of
They're going to take it higher than you can imagine.
Well, I guess that could happen. Everyone has their ways. What will you do, Dr. Rick Pappas, when July 1st comes and you aren't going into the office?
This is the question I get asked a lot, Shelley. And so I don't know. I know that... the proverbial, people say it often when they're in trouble, I want to spend more time with my family. Well, I really do want to spend more time. I've got 10 grandchildren, and I've got, and six of them are in different parts of the country. So, you know, I'm going to do that, but I'm going to do something. I'll tell you what, one thing I'm going to do. I found about 20, I read a lot of murder mysteries like Patterson and Grisham and Baldacci, and I found a book that I started about a murder on a university campus. And I'm going to finish that and get it published. And I can tell you one secret. The president does not die in this book.
All right. Shoo. Wipe that off.
Yeah, wipe that off the list.
Murder mysteries are popular, but people do die. Good that you will engage in that and certainly more. What's been a high point in your life? Davenport, yeah.
The highest point is always, and I love this about higher education, is that you can become anything you want to be. It's a transformational thing. And I remember one student specifically who was in our Lansing campus, and she was in a homeless shelter with a child, and she didn't know what to do, and she was afraid her daughter was going to get in trouble. And so she saw our Lansing campus, went to him. She wouldn't look you in the eyes. You know, and she started going to school there. She got her bachelor's in cyber, got her master's in cyber. She worked for the federal government, and now she's working at a high level in a position. She came back at her master's degree commencement, spoke at our commencement. It chills down your back. She's volunteering at the homeless shelter where she once was, and she was so articulate, so strong. It just shows the potential in every student. And this transformation happens that you can change your lives. Very few people are going to be a Martin Short in professional entertainment or a professional athlete. Only 2% of all athletes become a professional. And so this, I'll always remember, is how students grow and transform and then give back to the community.
What's your message to your faculty and staff?
How proud I am of them. You know, when we were in the pandemic and we went to 2 days to completely online, and we had all of these like Hollywood Squares boxes, you know, we're meeting with everybody and, you know, washing down our groceries and all this stuff. And they took care of our students. I was so impressed at how they just continued and moved on. And so my message to them is, welcome the new president. You know, you're so fantastic. You'll continue to grow and do good things. And so I will miss the human part of the interactions with people. But I'll still have human interactions.
Yes, you will be forced to. You will still be on the invite list. What's your message to your students?
Don't let somebody tell you that you can't achieve something. The obstacles, I told my kids when they were growing up, it's not a question if you're going to have obstacles in your life. The question is, how are you going to deal with it? And how do you overcome and respond and show persistence? One of the great characteristics of a successful person, never giving up. And you can do this. You know, our goal is to make sure that, I tell all the freshmen every year, we practice shaking hands. Because I said, I want you to be on that stage graduating and getting a great career. So my message is the same as it always has been. You can do this.
And you can do this, that R word or rewire word or whatever you plan starting July 1st. You've led Davenport University since 2009. You've guided the institution through a period of tremendous progress and strengthened impact. You are receiving this year's Peter C. Cook Excellence in Business Award come May 2nd. Anything else we need to know?
You got it. You know so much more than I do. So this is, it's always a pleasure to be with you.
Yes, Dr. Pappas, enjoy. Davenport.edu. Get your tickets for May 2nd. It'll be wonderful again with Martin Short. You have to prepare for your interviews. So I imagine you're getting prepared.
I am preparing. Oh. And we might even do, I shouldn't say this out loud, my staff would not like this, but a duet potentially. I figure that they can't get rid of me. Now I'm retiring,
no,
right?
This is your swan song. Is that the word I use?
It is.
All right. We'll get you back in studio to see how maybe your first 6 months are of retirement. How's that?
I appreciate it. All Thank right. you, Shelley.
Mavis, Davenport.edu. Thanks. Earlier this year, the Montague and Whitehall FFA chapters hosted Lucky Droppings. You might get a kick from this conversation. Of course, FFA, strong. I know even when I was young, and I'm sure stronger now with the leadership and those involved, including you, Willa Van Loon, representing the Montague FFA chapter. Willa, good morning.
Good morning.
You having fun in 11th grade?
Yeah, sure I am.
Wonderful. Thank you for you. All right. You are deemed our spokesperson, so we only get the best. So I want to kind of get into a reminder of the good work and the great organization of your FFA, but also what's been happening. Well, I'm going to say the word when it comes to poop. So there you are. Well, how would you describe FFA to a newcomer?
Yeah, for sure. So FFA has really strong roots within agriculture, but since our founding in 1928, we've expanded to offer more leadership opportunities and other various activities to fit the interests of nearly any student. One of my favorite aspects of FFA is probably its intense focus on giving back to the community. So like we regularly host community service days, including beach cleanups and tractor tire recycling drives, and even have a weekly volunteer group at Montague High School that maintains various landscaping areas and facilities throughout the school district.
Nice. What did you personally get involved?
I got involved about a quarter into my sophomore year when I transferred to Montague from Shelby Public Schools. Ms. Firestein and Mrs. Engel, two of my advisors, actually reached out to me and asked me to sing the national anthem at Farm Bureau's annual state meeting.
Man.
And so I went and sang there with a friend. Ms. Firestein, on the ride there, mentioned an ag issues group that was in need of another member. And so the day after I got back, I joined that group, and I've been going ever since.
Nice. Well, if we had time, I'd have you sing it for us, but we don't have time. There we are. Well, I do have time to talk about what you have been up to of late, the Montague and Whitehall FFA chapters. You hosted Lucky Droppings. What's this all about?
Yes, ma'am. So this is actually something Ms. Firestein came across when she was doing a little digging on some fun activities to do within our community. She came across something called cow poop bingo, funny enough, and she decided to do a little twist so it was a little bit more accessible, easy to transport animals, and she turned it into chicken poop bingo, and we called it Lucky Droppings. And so she reached out to me and asked if I would be willing to take in two chickens, and I said, yes, of course. And then the party got started.
Thank goodness you said yes. So how is it played?
How is it what? Sorry.
How is Lucky Droppings played? Because it is kind of a bingo thing.
Yes, it is. So, we decided to make a table with 50 squares on it, and we separated each of these squares out so they were equally sized. We charged $10 for each square, and the winner is determined by which square that my chicken, Brownie, graced her droppings with. And then the winner of this event got to choose where the $500 fundraised went to.
Cool. What are the chickens? And what do the chickens get out of it? They're safe, aren't they?
Yes, they are very safe. Brownie got to explore the world a little bit, and then her buddy Spider was there as a backup in case she didn't have to use the restroom.
How does this? We all know. Myself, growing up on a hobby farm, I had chickens, showed them in 4-H and all that good stuff. Where does this fit into FFA?
For sure. So I think this is relating back to those community aspects, giving back to the community. This is something that raises money for local charities. And the $500 that we raised were donated to Helen DeVos Children's Hospital this year. We actually plan to partner with Whitehall FFA again next year to host the event again. And it's really something that just gives back in a sense. Like, we're creating a fun way to entertain some of the attendees at a local football game and also raising money for an organization that benefits a lot of people.
Willa, would you agree with the headline that FFA is growing the next generation of leaders who will feed, fuel, clothe, sustain, and change the world like you?
Yes, ma'am, I would.
It's as easy as that. Thank you for that. Do you anticipate this being an annual event? And will you switch back and forth between a chicken or a cow or find another animal?
I think it would be a great idea to change it up maybe every couple of years, just to keep everything fresh and make sure that people are drawn into it. But I do believe that it will become an annual event.
What else did you learn from this, Willa Van Loon?
That's a great question. So it was one of my first experiences at a football game. So that separately was just a really cool first experience at a football game. I got to feel a different aspect of the community. I hadn't before. But then also, it was just extremely fun to interact with some of my neighbors and friends in a way that brought joy to everyone. There were no negative aspects of this, besides maybe Brownie being a little nervous that she was out in the open.
Very nice.
And away from her flock.
Yes. Yeah, even chickens miss their flock, I'm sure. Lastly, back to, again, you representing the FFA locally, but also nationally, most likely internationally, developing members to fill the talent pipeline for more than 350 careers in agriculture. Do you see either yourself or others going into this business?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I know several recently graduated friends of mine are looking to go into agricultural management, like helping environmental services to really maintain the health of our earth. And I myself am hoping to go back into agricultural education someday and maybe even teach at Montague to help other young students discover something that has made such a big impact on my life.
All right. Again, Willa, representing well and only in 11th grade, stay the course. Developing members to fill the talent pipeline to be a leader in the adult and obviously world you are now, but continuing the Montague and Whitehall FFA chapters hosting this lucky droppings and a little bit of chicken poop to talk about. Willa, how do we find out more information?
Yeah, so to find out more information, you are welcome to go to ffa.org. This is a great website to just really gain more knowledge on the FFA organization, what we offer, and how you can become involved or support our organization and our efforts.
Nice. You have a favorite subject at school?
Oh, gosh. Probably history or science. I know that's hard to, like, choose between the two, but I love valuing where we've come from and developing different prospects for our future.
Yeah. All right. You are there. Thank you very much, Willa Van Loon. Again, the Montague High School, Montague FFA chapter with this conversation. You take care.
Yeah, Thank you for the opportunity. You as well.
The work of my next guest transports readers, that's us, to the vibrant streets of the 1920s Paris, following a pair of fortune tellers, a girl and her grandmother, who must fight for their home and family as they come face to face with the dark choices of their family's past. Ooh, I'm going to dig into this. That's why we bring you on. We'll be seeing you and hearing from you April 2nd from our Schuler Books in Grand Rapids. But Alicia Salnikova Gilmore on the line across the pond in Chicago you live. Alicia, good morning.
Good morning.
Appreciate you. Looking forward to your April 2nd Schuler Grand Rapids visit. We'll go through the details of that. But until then, drive or fly safely across the pond. And I appreciate you, of course, writing No Stranger, The Witch and the Tsar, and, of course, The Haunting of Moscow House. Are you originally from the Moscow area?
Yes, originally. I was born in Moscow, and my family came over when I was about 7 years old to the United States. So I've been living here most of my life, but I definitely would visit family and go back every once in a while.
Nice to know our backstories. All right, let's get into why you've chosen fortune tellers for your, well, not only title, but storyline.
Yeah, well, you know, fortune telling came up a lot in my research from my previous books that you named. And I just became very curious about it, especially when I made the connection that the women of my family used to do some fortune telling, though they never called it that. I never associated what they did with actual fortune telling, which was very interesting. I just kind of realized it when I started the research for this book. So, of course, I had to learn all about these wonderful Slavic fortune-telling and spiritualist beliefs, practices, traditions, superstitions, though I had grown up around them. You know, for example, my great-aunt used to read my palm. But I never really, you know, thought of it as fortune-telling. She would just kind of take my palm, read it. Tell my future. That actually came true. All of it has come true, which is very eerie. At the same time, I do want to mention that with this book, I knew I wanted to write a book more inspired by my experiences as an immigrant in the United States. I knew when I was starting this book that the 1920s Paris was home to a very robust community of Russian emigres who had to flee the 1917 revolution and civil war for a better life. And I knew I wanted to write about people like me, but in a very different time and place. And particularly, I really wanted to explore a family of women having to survive in immigration and still being pursued, haunted, if you will, by their past in the old country and the difficult, rather dark decisions they've had to make to get to their new life and their new country. Mm. And it was definitely a bonus to learn there were actual fortune tellers in the Russian emigre community in Paris in the 1920s.
Well, again, that's what research does, plus your own passion. The fortune tellers of Rue de Rue, tell me about these last two words.
Yes, Rue de Rue. I am probably saying it wrong. Actually, contrary to what you might think based on this book, mm-hmm. I actually am not a French speaker. I actually had to make sure the French was correct in my book through my mother-in-law, who speaks French. Rue de Rue, it's a street in the heart of Paris. And it was home to part of the Russian emigre community in Paris. There were different neighborhoods that, had these Russians living there at the time. But Rue de Rue was kind of the epicenter. And it was the epicenter because to this day there stands a Orthodox cathedral that would kind of attract all kinds of people, not only for church service, but it was sort of the center of the community. You know, people would gather there and there would be Russian-speaking stores and newspapers being sold on the street and food. And so it was a very kind of thriving community of Russian emigres. And so I actually had an opportunity to visit the street when I was in Paris for a research trip on this book. And it was so fun to even see these echoes even today. I mean, in fact, where the tea room that I have in my book stands, there's actually a Russian restaurant there. So it wasn't hard for me to imagine maybe a very mysterious, let's say, tea room in its place 100 years before.
Again, speaking with the author of The Fortune Tellers of Rue de Rue, Alicia Salnikova-Gilmore. You'll be speaking this, as we've mentioned, Thursday, April 2nd at Schuller Books in Grand Rapids. Talk to us a little bit about what we'll witness from your presentation.
we'll talk about the book and some of my inspiration behind it, some of my research behind it. It is always really fun for me to talk about with readers at an actual event, face-to-face is the best time to meet people, talk about my work, and especially this book. I'm very excited to share it. It has so much of me in it and also so much of my relationship with my grandmother, as it is about a girl and her grandmother. And it's really fun for me to talk about that relationship, which is a very close bond. And also just to talk about my writing process for the book. So I'm very excited to meet readers. I actually haven't been to Michigan since I was probably 9 years old. And I actually last went to Michigan when visiting my parents' friends, who kind of befriended and accepted my family when we came over to the States. So they invited us to their Christmases every single year in Michigan. So Michigan is a very special place for me, and I'm just really excited to get back.
Well, let's, as they say, fill the house. Schuller Books in Grand Rapids on 28th Street, a wonderful venue come Thursday night. Any other themes to discuss, Alicia, before we start to let you go?
You know, I think just the fact that women are incredible. This book is about, women in immigration, yes, but also I think in every time and place, not only surviving, making families, setting up their businesses, but really the connections between women. And that it can really save us. And so I think that this is a book about women. It's about the book of, about the women of my family, yes, but also just all women surviving, thriving, and being there for their families.
All right. Well, safe travels to you. This an important week for you as you present your work at Schuller Books in Grand Rapids, of course, on the 2nd. All right, Alicia, let's talk about how we find out more information about the Fortune Tellers of Rue de Rue.
Yeah, so I have a website. It's aliciagilmore.com. And I'm also on social media, especially Instagram and Facebook at Alicia Author.
And, of course, that Alicia, O-L-E-S-Y-A, you one and only Alicia. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
It's an incredibly moving story by Newbery Honor winning author, number one New York Times bestseller author Jasmine Warga on the line. Her new book for middle grade readers, The Unlikely Tale of Chase and Finnegan, inspired by true stories from zoos across the country, specifically the Cheetah Ambassador Program at the Cincinnati Zoo. And of course, the power of friendship and can transcend anything, even species. So this is kind of cool how it got started. Good morning to you, Jasmine, and carry on from there.
And it's based off of real-life programs at zoos across the country where they really do bring shelter dogs in to be friends with cheetahs. And I thought this was such an amazing real-life program that I wanted to fictionalize it in a novel.
Yes, so let's take that apart. Chase and Finnegan, an unlikely friendship. Talk to me about the inspiration by true stories from zoos across the country. Maybe an example.
Yeah, so a really famous companion dog of the Cincinnati Zoo's name is Remus, and they've brought him in to work with different cubs who oftentimes in human care, there's only one cub in a litter or only one cub survives, but cheetahs need a playmate, right? They need a playmate for development and socialization, and a dog kind of is that surrogate sibling for them because they are really affectionate with their trainers, but it's important to teach cheetahs that you can't play with a human the way you could play with another animal, and so the dog provides that outlet. And what I also love about it, though, is that the dog gets this wonderful, loving home because, as we know, there's so many dogs across the country that are in need of really good homes.
Guilty. Three myself in the Irwin household. What's the heart of this unlikely friendship, if you can share that? And what do you hope your young readers see in these two characters?
Yeah, so I think at the heart of it, at least for Finnegan, he's lost his home. And so he has this misguided idea that he has to be perfect all the time to be worthy of love and to get to keep this home. And he's really, really afraid of making a mistake. I think a big part of the book is him learning that it's okay to make mistakes. He doesn't have to be perfect all the time. And I hope young readers take that away. I think we're in this moment right now where young people feel so much stress, right? And they feel stress to be perfect all the time. And understanding that the friends in our life will love us even when we make mistakes and they're there for us. And then for Chase, she feels lots of pressure. She feels like she's the only one, that she has to represent her species. And this idea that we aren't ever the only one, right? And even people who are different from us are there to support us.
Talking about the latest book out by my guest, Jasmine Warga, The Unlikely Tale of Chase and Finnegan. Tell me a little bit about your work, exploring themes of home, belonging, identity with this latest novel, Found Family, Another Dimension of Connecting. What does it mean to find home in ourselves and our families, chosen or otherwise?
Yeah, so I think home is a feeling, right, more than a place. This is something that I thought about all the time as a kid. So my father is an immigrant from Jordan, and I was always thinking about how more than one place to me felt like home. But what home really is a place where you feel secure, where you feel like you can fully be yourself and that you are supported. And I think I love to write stories about belonging, because when I was a kid, because of my hyphenated identity, I was constantly searching for belonging, and my work is sort of a way of writing my own childhood self into wholeness in the hope that other kids feel that too.
And your gift of writing interior lives for middle grade readers, how did you find Chase's voice? How's it different from characters you've written before?
Yeah, so writing from an animal perspective was tricky, right? Because you have to be authentic to the language an animal would use, and you have to think about the way that an animal is going to perceive the world. So you might have a beautiful metaphor, but if it doesn't make sense for a cheetah to use that language, you can't anymore. But I think what was so fun about this book was doing research for both Chase, the cheetah character, and Finnegan, the dog character's voice. And for Finnegan in particular, dogs have incredible noses. They experience the world through a scent-forward mode, whereas for humans, our dominant sense is sight. But with Finnegan, I was constantly peeling it back and thinking about, okay, how would he describe this? For example, dogs smell emotions, and so that gave a really creative aspect to the language in the book that I was able to think deeply about. What does happiness smell like? What does anxiety smell like? How can I detail that in a way that a reader is really going to believe that a cheetah or a dog is narrating the story to them?
Do you get back to the Cincinnati Zoo often?
I do. So my parents still live in Cincinnati, and I take my girls there every summer. And it was actually at the Cincinnati Zoo a few years ago that I first had this idea for a book when I was watching the cheetah run, which is a program they have there where you can watch a cheetah go from like 0 miles per hour to 90 miles per hour. It's a magnificent experience. But then they brought out this dog and explained about the relationship between the cheetah and the dog. And I got so intrigued by this, and also was thinking about how it provided an outlet to tell a story that I thought would touch on a lot of themes that are important to me.
That's cool. You may know this, but way back when, there was a Cheetah Run 5K that I've done several times. Need to bring that back. I digress. The Unlikely Tale of Chase and Finnegan. It's inspired by true stories from zoos across the country. And yes, it does involve Chase and Finnegan. Good to speak with you, Jasmine. How do we find out more information?
Yeah, so you can visit me at my website, jasminemorga.com. The book is available wherever you like to get your books, purchase your books, and also would be available at your local library. And you can also follow me on Instagram at jasminemorgabooks.
All right, take care. Thanks for the inspiration and this talk of Chase and Finnegan. Take care.
Thank you.
Your inspiration for the day on this terrific Tuesday, Edith Sitwell says, winter is the time for comfort, for good food and warmth, for the touch of a friendly hand, and for a talk beside the fire. It's time for home. Well, winter will be well remembered in this 2026. Let's move on to spring. Hope you enjoyed the show. I'm Shelley Irwin.